Good morning, everyone. Yatin Suneja from Guggenheim Biotech team here. Welcome, everybody, to our fourth annual Immunology and Neurology Day. Our first presenting company of the day today is Larimar, and from the company, we have President and Chief Executive Officer Carole Ben-Maimon. Carole, fireside format we have, but I'm going to give you 5 minutes to just give a high-level overview of the Larimar story, where we stand currently today, and what are some of the key milestones, and then I'll go into the Q&A portion.
Great. Thanks, Yatin. Thanks for having us. As you may or may not know, we are a biotech company. We're clinical stage. We have our lead compound is CTI-1601. It's in development for the treatment of Friedreich's ataxia, a rare genetic neurodegenerative disease where people are actually born feeling normal, looking healthy. Around puberty, they become clumsy. They are wheelchair-bound in their 20s, and they ultimately die in their 30s and 40s. It's really an awful disease. It's an autosomal recessive disease. So parents carry it. They don't know that they can pass it on to their children because as carriers, they're completely healthy. The disease is caused by a missing protein called frataxin. And frataxin is a protein that's actually active in the mitochondria and active in the electron transport chain in the production of iron-sulfur clusters. And so the challenge here is if you want to replace frataxin in these patients, you need to be able to get it not only into the bloodstream, but also across the cell membrane and across the mitochondrial membrane. The technology we have allows us to do that. It is a cell-penetrating peptide attached to the mitochondrial targeting sequence, which is the sequence that carries the protein across the mitochondrial membrane. And that is cleaved off once the protein is in the mitochondria, and it leaves the active frataxin moiety there to do whatever it's supposed to do. And so we filed our IND back in 2019 in the fall, started a SAD and MAD study throughout 2019 and 2020. We completed the MAD study in the first quarter of 2021. That study is in patients with Friedreich's ataxia. And we were able to demonstrate that not only was the drug safe and well tolerated up to 100 milligrams for 13 days, it also showed increases in frataxin levels, which is what's important because that's what the intent of the molecule is to replace frataxin in the buccal cells, so inside the cheek, as well as in the skin and in platelets. And there was a dose-dependent response. In the MAD study, there were actually three cohorts: a 25 milligram cohort for 4 days, and then every 72 hours out to day 13, a 50 milligram cohort for 7 days daily, and then every other day out to day 13, and then the 100 milligrams daily for the full 13 days. And we did show, as I said, increases in frataxin levels. Concurrently with that, we were conducting a six-month monkey study in NHPs to support long-term dosing of the molecule. And in that study, we had some mortalities. And in May of 2021, we were placed on clinical hold while we completed that study. That study was still ongoing, and I'm talking about the monkey study. The MAD study, as I said, had already completed. We finished that study and finished dosing in July and submitted all the data to the FDA in January of 2022. At that time, they asked a few questions. They had responded in February. We had a Type C meeting with them in the second quarter, and then the clinical hold was lifted after we submitted a complete response in September. In September, we started back in the clinic with a four-week dose escalation study. It's 14 days daily at 25 milligrams, and then every other day. And we have announced most recently that we are currently enrolling for that study, and it's on target to give preliminary information as to what's next in the second quarter of 2023 and top-line data in the second half of 2023. So we're very excited that we do have some near-term targets. We also raised $70 million plus a shoe in September, And we could close. We announced in our third quarter earnings that we have just under $125 million, which gives us a 2-year runway, which takes us obviously into the second half of 24.
All right, Carol, thank you for that overview. So a couple specific questions. Can you maybe remind us what was the, number one, actually, have you been able to identify the reason for mortality in these NHPs? And then, you know, what sort of supporting documentation or data were presented to the FDA that led you back to the clinic?
Yeah, so we believe that the toxicities, first of all, there were 3 monkeys that died out of a total of 34. There were 4 dose groups and vehicle in that study, and the mortalities were at the higher dose groups. They were not at the lower dose groups. We did have an NOAEL that was established in that study. It looks like the monkeys died due to high levels of drug. We had a lot of accumulation in that drug, disproportionate, quite honestly. And so the monkeys that had mortalities were had very high concentrations. And so the data that we were able to submit to FDA is data basically showing that if you look at AUC, Cmax, or Ctrough, and you look at take the NOAEL from any of the studies, we have a 4-week study, a 90-day study, and the 26-week study. There were no mortalities in any of the other studies. If you take the NOAELs from those studies and you compare them by dividing them to either the 25 milligram in the patients or the 50 milligram, we have safety margins that are generally greater than 10, so quite substantial safety margins. And so the agency was comfortable letting us move forward with the 25 milligram dose. We will be submitting to FDA that data with our proposal as what to do next, how to proceed next. And so that'll be happening once we finish dosing and we analyze all of the data.
Got it. So even at the 50 milligram, let's say you go to the 50 milligram, and I'll come back to the trial design in a bit, you do have at least 10x margin from safety perspective.
Yes. Right.
Very good.
I didn't say at least. I said generally.
Okay.
The 10x margin, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so now in this phase 2 study, so you are starting with 25, going up to 50. The first question is, how many patients are you hoping to enroll in the 25? And based on the PK modeling and whatever experience you have so far, do you think you could increase frataxin level with chronic dosing at least to day 14 with 25?
Yeah,
and to what level?
Yeah, so we have 12 to 15 patients. It is a 2-to-1 randomization, so it is placebo-controlled. And that's what the full cohort. There'll be another cohort, hopefully, at another dose or another regimen as we see the data from this. But we do believe that we may be able to increase. We obviously don't know. In the MAD study, we only dosed for 4 days daily. Mm-hmm. And then we went to every 72 hours. And given 2 things, one, the half-life of the drug, and the second, the fact that frataxin may have a longer half-life than CTI-1601, we do believe that there is a possibility that if dosed daily for a longer period of time, frataxin levels would go up.
Got it. Then in terms of frataxin level, I think there is still debate in the field that what is a clinical meaningful improvement. We had Dr. Perlman yesterday. She talked about that if you can get frataxin level to maybe 30% of normal, you start seeing you should experience some clinical benefit. Is that the bar that you are shooting for, maybe get up to that 30% level or maybe higher?
Yeah, so in the MAD study with the 50 milligrams daily and the 100 milligrams daily, we were able to get to around 50 to 60% of normal healthy people. But as you said, there is significant debate in the field as to exactly what the target should be. I think one thing's very clear, you don't want to be too high. Mm-hmm. For tax at very high levels is toxic, we think. And clearly, in this case, more is not necessarily better. But I think what we want to see with the 25 milligram is any increase that we really think is real. We can always go up from there, but at least we would like to see some increase And if we don't, we still have the ability to go up to 50, where we know we saw a significant increase in frataxin to almost heterozygous levels.
Got it. The 50 milligram dose that you had used in phase one was dosed to day seven, right? Not to day 14.
Daily into day seven.
Day seven. Okay. So even with that, you are getting to that level. Okay.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the accumulation in NHPs. Do we know if that phenomena exists, or in patient, are we seeing accumulation at all based on the phase one experience?
It's an important point. We did not see it, but remember, we only dosed for 13 days. Okay. And so that's part of the reason for taking a little bit slower here and dosing for 14 days daily and then going to every other day, because we think we may be able to maintain frataxin levels even at every other day dosing because of the half-life of frataxin.
Got it.
But getting more information is really critical to answering a lot of those questions.
Got it. So so before you move with the 50 or into the 50 milligram dose, I think the 25 milligram dose data needs to be submitted to the FDA for review. What specific requirements FDA has? Like, what do you need to show to convince them, okay, everything is good, we're moving to 50?
Yeah, I think they haven't laid out a plan, and we don't usually talk about the details of our conversations with FDA. Obviously, they want to be comfortable that it's safe. So I think we need to show them, one, that the patients did well and that it was safe, that we understand the pharmacokinetics and prevent any accumulation if there should be an issue. But clearly, you can do that by changing your dose regimen or changing your dose. And then lastly, that we have a path forward where when we do our modeling, we can still maintain our safety margins. That's, as a physician, that's what I would want to see. So I suspect that's what they will want to see.
Got it. Will you be disclosing the 25 milligram data to the street, or is just for the FDA and you move on and then we only get data once 50 is done?
So, again, I don't know whether it'll be 50. I just want to make sure the second cohort may be 25 every single day. I don't, you know, I have to wait till we see the data. But we will be giving guidance in the second quarter that basically tells folks, you know, what are the next steps? FDA has cleared us. They haven't cleared us. We're going to a 50 milligram dose. We're going to a 35 milligram dose. We're going to daily, whatever it is that we're going to be doing next. We'll give you some guidance. I don't think we're going to be releasing data. The reason for that is the data will still be blinded. In order to maintain the integrity of the study and maintain the integrity of the second cohort, we will be looking at the data in a blinded fashion. And so we want to make sure that we maintain that blind. But if there is anything material, of course we will release it.
Got it. With regard to the next dose, whether it's 50, 35, is the design, everything is dependent on what you learn from 25, or do you have a pretty good sense that, all right, if we have to go up, it'll most likely be chronic for 14 days?
I think we have to wait and see the data. The purpose for doing the study is to learn more. You know, we build these very complex models, and the models are only as good as the data, but the more information you can feed into those models, the better the information that it can spit out. So, you know, we have limited data now because of the MAD. It's just a MAD study and SAD study, but that's even more limited.
Yeah.
So this data will help us very much make the appropriate decisions as we move forward.
Got it. In terms of the patient population, what type of patients are you hoping to enroll in these studies, the 12 to 15 patient cohort?
Yeah, so we're enrolled ambulatory and non-ambulatory patients. They have to be over 18 years of age, so we're not in children yet. We are looking at patients who they can have been in the MAD or SAD study, but they don't have to be. So they can be drug naive, or they could have participated in our phase one program.
Got it. Okay. And then as you, actually the question is, what about, so as you move beyond phase two, once you have finalized the dose, how are you thinking about the pivotal program? One study, what type of endpoints you think you would need to show or run studies on?
Yeah, so obviously everybody else in the field has been required to do a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, so we fully anticipate that that is the case. We are trying to build a database that is a foundation and provides supportive evidence. So looking at frataxin levels is really important. Looking at some biochemical measures is really important. But the phase three likely will look at some neurological endpoint. I think some of this is going to depend on some of the other programs. If there are other approved products on the market, then I think it'll be important that we look at what the requirements were for those products, obviously, because that will have set a precedent. If there are no other products on the market, then we'll have to be having communications with FDA. Obviously, MFARS is very much out there and people are talking about it. It's a bit of a noisy, messy measure, but it's there. There's also some publications out there that look at upright stability, which seems to be more predictable and more reproducible and less subjective by the observer, so less variability. And there's a very nice publication out of Farah and by Christian Rummy that has shown that upright stability does correlate with loss of ambulation, clearly a clinically relevant endpoint. We have not had any of those conversations with any of the regulatory authorities at this time. It would have been inappropriate since we were on clinical hold, and we want to get at least the safety data to know that we have a path forward and that we can raise frataxin levels, which we fully believe we can. But we need to collect the data in order to submit that to FDA and then begin those conversations.
Got it. In terms of the preclinical data, have you been able to demonstrate that you are able to increase frataxin level in CNS in NHPs?
So we have not in NHPs, and the reason we have not is NHPs are healthy. They're normal. They have normal frataxin levels. And so the blood-brain barrier may not behave the same in healthy animals or in healthy people as it does in diseased patients. And there's plenty of evidence of that in the literature and with other drugs. I mean, the best example is meningitis, where penicillin doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier in somebody who's not sick, but when you have meningitis and inflamed meninges, it very easily crosses the blood-brain barrier and is actually the drug of choice. So I think it's a little bit challenging to use normal healthy animals to then hypothesize what might happen in patients. What we do have is TAT, our cell-penetrating peptide, has been shown to cross the blood-brain barrier with other cargo, not with frataxin, but it has been shown to take other cargo across the blood-brain barrier. Second, Dr. Payne did a study in the neuro knockout where frataxin is knocked out in brain, spinal cord, and dorsal root ganglion. And he showed that he could prevent the development of the ataxia in those animals. He could prolong their survival. And when he took out the brain, the dorsal root ganglion, and the spinal cord, he was able to measure human frataxin in those tissues. And so that's another piece of evidence. And finally, we did dose NHPs and do lumbar punctures after 14 days. And we did see human frataxin in the CSF. Which suggests that it does get across the blood-brain barrier. So although we don't have tissue penetration information in NHPs or for that matter, other than the neuro knockouts, other models, it does look like it does cross the blood-brain barrier.
Is it necessary for it to cross the blood-brain barrier or the other compartments like cardio, which is the big mortality, it leads to big mortality in these patients, about 50%, that's enough?
Yeah, I think it's enough. I think we would have a drug that would be very important to patients because, like you said, many of these patients die from cardiac disease, mm-hmm. And this is truly a systemic disease. They also develop diabetes. The other thing you have to keep in mind is the dorsal root ganglia, which is clearly implicated here, is actually not in this. It's right outside the spinal cord, so it's not actually in the CSF, in the CNS. Even though it's considered a CNS organ. And then the last piece is a major component to the morbidity may actually be skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle is very high in mitochondria. It's obviously a very energy-using, burning tissue. And so clearly having an effect on skeletal muscle may actually have a real clinical effect as well.
Got it. Very good. And then a question I have is on the competition and the impact it could have on you. I mean, as you know, Reata's omaveloxolone is under FDA review. We think it could get approved next year. Can you just talk about what the implications would be if their drug gets approved? Would you be able to enroll a study in a timely fashion? Would you have to generate data on top of OMAV? Just like all the implications, if you can summarize for us.
Yeah, so obviously we've thought about it. And look, these patients don't have anything that's approved, right? So we wish them all the best, and we want them to have access to as many products as they effective products as they possibly can. Right now, we don't think that it'll be an issue for the 200 study, the current study that we're conducting. There is a very different mechanism of action. We're actually replacing frataxin, which is clearly at the root cause, whereas OMAV is related to NRF2 and so oxidative stress. So we think that, you know, from a mechanism of action perspective, we may have a broader effect on more of the components of the disease. I can't prove that. It just, you know, it's just because of the mechanism of action. We can also go to Europe. That's the other possibility. But clearly, this, and as in many, many diseases, it may not be one drug is the be-all to end-all. You may need to have more than one drug affecting. And it may depend on where you are in your disease as well, because some of these, some of the findings and some of the morbidity may be related to compensatory problems. And so you may need more than one drug. So clearly figuring out how to study both drugs will be important and study both drugs together. But I think initially our first goal is to show that we're safe, that we can get to a dose that has an increase in frataxin, and then start to tackle what will be the best way to handle the clinical outcomes in the clinic itself.
Got it. Carol, I think that's all I had for you, and this is the lot of time we had. I thank you very much for joining us virtually. Very good discussion. Good luck with the studies.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, bye-bye.